In the Literary License Podcast, Kings of Horror episodes, reading and digesting books from the masters of modern horror, and viewing the films. Your co-hosts tonight are Vicky Ray, Leandro Gazzi, Craig Johnson, David Grant, and Keith Shogun, giving you a word-by-word, scene-by-scene, and everything in between, and everything in between, and everything in between, and everything in between.
Welcome to Literary License Podcast, and it's our Books to Screen, or the Kings of Horror episode. We'll be covering Cabal by Clive Barker and Nightbreed. And today we have with us, we have Leandro Gazzi. Hello, Leandro.
Hi, how are you too?
I'm just doing super gravy, and it's a rainy Saturday evening here. So yeah, drip, drip, drip. And then we have Craig Johnson with us. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Keith. Hi, Leandro.
Hi.
So, before we get started, let's find out what we've been up to since last time we spoke to each of you. Starting with you, Craig, what have you been up to since last time we spoke to you?
Since last time, I've been working on a new t-shirt and hoodie design based on the Nintendo Mario Mushrooms, and been working on some merchandise, and I'm going to get it out very soon. It'll be in the newsletter, or there'll be links in the newsletter, I think. And just watch this space. I'm working on some
cool
stuff, but yeah, it's nice to see like some artwork that I've made like actually on a product. It's weird to see it like that, but it looks cool. So that'll be one of my things. And and also one of the other pieces is called The Witch is Dead, which is a modern take of The Wizard of Oz, where the house has fallen on the witch and you see the legs sticking out. And I've done it in, it's set in North Finchley at my uncle's old house where his old garage was. And that's also going to be on water bottles and some pillows and things like that, cushions, stuff like that. It's very minimal, very, very gothic. And it kind of fits the feel for this, or even the 24180s, if you're into that type of thing, then it's probably right up your street. So yeah, most of my stuff is like, a lot of my inspiration from my artwork and photography comes from my hometown of East Finchley in North London, and that's where I get my ideas when I'm out taking pictures and not lurking around graveyards. As you do. And you can check.
What are you getting up to?
Well, I've been like settling down the new job. Yesterday, I went to Arnold Schwarzenegger exposition in Birmingham, and yeah, pretty much just that, reading. That's all. And you?
Well, myself, I signed a 3-picture deal with Prometheus Films, so editing the scripts and stuff for that for television and film. Bat for Blood comes out next week, so that comes out on the 12th of October. So in the meantime, so from the 15th, 16th, and 17th on Xbox and PlayStation, you can meet the cast and crew and everyone who worked on Back to Blood and play in online games with them, and I'll be part of that. If you want to play with myself, my gamer tag for Xbox is Wolf the Only 666, and I'll be on there with other people who are playing Back for Blood, excuse me, to help celebrate the opening of the release of the game. And outside of that, been watching some stuff on Netflix, but nothing really comes to mind. So I think I've been doing a lot of time filling at the moment without actually watching anything fulfilling. Well, that brings us to Cabal by Clive Barker. Cabal is a 1988 horror novel by the British author Clive Barker. It was originally published in the United States as part of a collection comprising a novel and several short stories from Barker's sixth and final volume of The Books of Blood. The book, of course, was adapted into a film, Nightbreed, in 1990, and was written and directed by Clive Barker himself, starring Craig Schaefer and David Cronenberg. A television adaptation is in development at the Sci-Fi Channel, directed by Michael Dougherty and written by Josh Stahlberg, and these are the same people who will bring in you Chucky, the TV series, out the 12th of October. So all we'll do is cut to synopsis and be right back to discuss Cabal by Clive Barker.
Cabal by Clive Barker. The synopsis. Boone, a young man suffering from an unspecified mental disorder, is told by his trusted psychiatrist, Decker, that he is responsible for brutal serial murders in Calgary. Boone, however, has no recollection of committing these murders. After a suicide attempt, Boone begins searching for Midian, a semi-mythical city that he sees in his dreams that supposedly offers sanctuary to monsters and miscreants collectively known as the Nightbreed. After a suicide attempt, Boone is taken to a clinic and told by a fellow patient named Narcisse that he knows where Midian is, as he is seeking entry into the city himself. Thinking this is a Nightbreed test of Narcisse's resolve, Narcisse reveals Midian's location to Boone and manically savages his own face with a razor. Horrified, Boone escapes the clinic. Following Narcisse's directions, Boone locates Midian, only to discover that the city lies beneath a cemetery. At the cemetery, two of the Nightbreed reveal themselves and attack Boone. One of the assailants bites into Boone's neck, but he narrowly manages to escape. Decker appears and reveals to Boone that Decker himself had committed the serial murders and framed Boone as the scapegoat. Boone is then shot dead by the local policeman who had been pursuing him alongside Decker. Boone's body is placed in a morgue, but is laterally, mysteriously disappears. Boone's lover, Lori, is unable to cope with what she's been told about Boone, so she decides to travel to Midian for answers. Along the way, she makes friends with Cheryl, who decides to accompany her, though Cheryl stays in town and does not enter the cemetery. Lori encounters a small, frail creature writhing in pain at the cemetery. One of the Nightbreed, Rachel, begs Lori to bring the creature to her. When she does so, the creature transforms into a human child, Rachel's daughter, Babette. As thanks, Rachel informs Lori that she knows Lori has come for Boone, but Rachel is silenced by the Nightbreed leader, Lylesburg. Before she can reveal any more information, Lori is refused entrance to the city. Meanwhile, Decker, having gained Cheryl's trust by seducing her beforehand, kills Cheryl and reveals his identity to Lori. Lori narrowly escapes Decker's attacks and returns to Midian, where revived Boone saves her with his new Nightbreed power against Lylesburg's wishes. As punishment, by the will of Midian's creator, Baphomet, Lylesburg commands the couple to leave Midian. Reunited, Boone and Lori return to the hotel that Lori was staying at, only to discover that Decker has already been there and has massacred many people inside. The police arrive, and though Lori is able to flee, Boone degenerates into an animal state at the sight of Decker's carnage, eating some of the dead bodies before getting arrested. Decker convinces the police chief, the bigoted radical Egerman, to go to Midian and capture or kill everyone living there. Eggerman sends a small squad of officers to scout Midian in order to confirm the fact that there are people there. Eggerman's men capture and kill Anaka, one of the Nightbreed, an event witnessed by Babette, who telepathically transmits the information to Lori. Lori meets up with Narcissus, and together they help Boone escape from jail. Elsewhere, Eggerman and Decker organize a lynch mob made up of policemen and volunteers to attack Midian. Eggerman takes a priest called Ashbury along. Boone, Nori, and Narcissus find that Eggerman's men have overrun Midian, that many of the Nightbreed have been killed, forcing them out from the underground by setting the city aflame. Decker manages to kill Narcissus during the battle, but Boone later has a final confrontation with Decker and kills him. Eggers' men are chased off by the Nightbreed, but Midian is completely destroyed, and many Nightbreed have been killed. Eggerman and Ashbury decide to form a team in order to eradicate the Nightbreed. Baphomet rebaptizes Boone as Cabal and grants him new power, tasking him with finding a new home for the Nightbreed, a task he accepts. And that is the synopsis for Cabal by Clive Barker.
Hello, welcome back to Literature License Podcast. We're discussing Cabal by Clive Barker. And starting with you, Craig, what are your thoughts of Cabal?
The book was probably just the right size for me to read in the space that I had, sort of thing. It was a good size. I think it was a little gem, really, because it was like a subterranean underworld of fantasy and little spoils and things that I think the book really demonstrated really well compared to the film. But the film was pretty excellent as well. And I think it was nice to learn about the characters such as Peliquin. I found him quite intriguing. Even the names were just really quite beautiful and exotic. And I've got an excerpt, actually, that I'm going to read, which is, "Her gaze went with her into a room with walls of frozen earth and a floor the same. The latter split from corner to corner, and a fissure opened in it from which a flame column rose 4 or 5 times the size of a man. There was a cold of it rather than heat, and no reassuring flicker in its heart. Instead, its innards churned upon themselves, turning over and over some fright of stuff which she failed to recognize at first, but her appalled stare rapidly interpreted. There was a body in the fire, hacked limb from limb, human enough that she recognized it as flesh, but no more than that. Baphomet's doing, presumably, some torment visited on a transgressor. Boone said the baptizer's name even now, and she readied herself for sight of its face. She had it too, but from inside the flame as the creature there, not dead but alive, not Midian's subject, but its creator, rolled its head in the turmoil of flame and looked her way. This was Baphomet." And that was Clive Barker's Cabal. Now, in the movie, obviously, Baphomet was slightly different, but still kind of cool. In a way, I would have preferred more of an impetus of Baphomet in the movie, but we can talk about that after. But yeah, it was a really cool book, and I think for its time as well. I mean, it was pretty. Nothing had really been done before based on the underworld, and to have that amount of characters as well in one setting, like one scene. I think maybe as an animation it might have been good, or it could definitely do with a remake, I think, or a TV series even, because you could learn so much from the characters, and then you could have origin stories and all sorts. I mean, we've opened up a whole can of worms now, Keith.
Well, a TV series is in development by the Sci-Fi Channel, so we'll see if that comes to fruition. What about yourself, Leandro? What are your thoughts of Cabal?
I really enjoyed it. At the beginning, it was a bit confusing to understand the first 2-3 chapters it was not clear for me, you know, if like he was talking, the doctor was talking with the patient, you know, but it was, the conversation were a bit not like straightforward, a bit complicated. Then as a carry-on reading was, I got it, was easy to understand. As Craig said, I really enjoyed it because it's a short book and they have divided in different like chapters. So it's, and the chapters are not big. So it's like easy to, you know, read it, stop and then carry on whenever you can. I really like the story. And one of the things that I really like about this podcast is like the stories that we have been reading, they are set in different places in the world. And for example, this one was like more like kind of like north of North America and Canada, because they were talking about some towns near there.
The Winter Olympics took place about 15 years ago.
Yeah, and well, I have been living in USA, in North Dakota. So it was really easy to me when they were describing the place to imagine, you know, those places that maybe I don't know, like are not a lot of like trees. It's like more like deserted areas. I really enjoy the way he like tells you the story of, you know, when the characters appears and how everything's going on. I really enjoy it. Yeah. Interesting, you know, also the way he tells, you know, the underworld and yes, I think it's like a kind of like different view. I mean, then you ended realizing that, I don't know, like, but at least to me, you know, it's like they were kind of monster, but they were not evil, you know. They're imagine if they were attacking someone, it's because they were having to want to eat, kind of like that, right? But they were not coming to destroy anything. They were staying in that place where they were, like, being there. So, yeah, I really enjoyed the story.
I mean, Kabbalah is kind of a odd little story because you think that you're on a mission with Boone, but I found that's quite interesting, that Boone is like the prologue, and then basically it's the story of Lori, really. Because basically, after the prologue, and after he, you know, next thing you know, now we're on Laurie's quest for the rest of the book, sort of thing. And I thought that was quite interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, it is quite. I mean, you know, Clive Barker is a gay author. I guess at this time he wasn't out, but I guess it would have been too hard to figure it out because he spent a lot of time talking about Boone's beautiful penis. So you're kind of like, okay, this is kind of weird from a male author. This is something you kind of find like in by a female author sort of thing. They're like, okay. But I thought it was quite interesting. And I thought, though I have to sit there and say that it's, there is, if you've read any other Clive Barker stuff, this is probably the easiest one to probably get into. In The Great and Secret Show, or whether it's Hellbound Heart, or whether it's Weed World and other stuff that he's come out with, everything has a pseudo sexualness to it. And this one, I have set this to say that there was some, you know, sex, you know, some sex in it, but it was quite toned down. It wasn't the whole pseudo sexual S&M kind of, you know, brutality that he tends to put into his work. So I thought that Kabbal is probably, if you never read Clive Barker, I think Kabbal is probably a good place to start, sort of thing. And then you kind of, you can start weaving yourself into his darker stuff from this one here. But I think this is a good starting point.
And compared to, say, something like the Hellraiser series, this was almost a bit quite romantic for Clive Barker, because at one point you're reading away and then you think, hold on, this could be Beauty and the Beast, because he's been bitten by Peliquin. He's becoming a shapeshifter. He's going to become more demonic, but he doesn't want her to see him like this, and he's trying to hide away. And yeah, I quite like that. And it was also, they like to question death, and it was quite an interesting topic to suggest, to say, you know, we're living in this sanctuary for dead people, and we are shapeshifters that embrace death, and this is how we live. and the sunlight can burn our skin and things like that. And that one of the other quotes that was one that says, "Of all the rash and midnight promises made in the name of love, none Boone now knew was more certain to be broken than I'll never leave you." What? And then some. And then another line was, "Dead isn't bad," Narcisse said. "It isn't even that different." So it's quite interesting, and it's quite. And back then, it would have been quite taboo. I mean, what year was this again? It was in the 80s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Or 90s. So that would have been quite revolutionary, really, for writing and cinema. So it's pretty cool.
I found another thing with Clive Barker. I mean, at this time, he wrote this in England. He was still in England at the time. Clive Barker's from Liverpool. And by this time, he's living in Muswell Hill when he wrote Cabal. So what's quite interesting is that reading it, it comes across as a very American, North American novel, which has that kind of feel to it. Because there's a difference between reading an English author and an American author in the way that things are written. And I was going to say this, that this had a real American feel to it as far as reading it. It's quite, not a lot of flowery writing going on. It's quite straightforward, kind of like puts you there. And I thought that he captured Canada very, very well as far as the destitute, the, you know, the long, you know, long country, desolate highways and to get to where you're going. And this, that is Canada. You know, once you pass Toronto, that's pretty much it. Your civilization's pretty destitute in Canada, sort of thing. And Alberta, where this takes place, is even more destitute, sort of thing. It's a bit like going to Wisconsin or Montana or somewhere like that. And I thought that he captured that very, very good. And there was also a coldness to it, I have to admit. But you're reading it, and it just feels like the whole place that they're at is cold. It doesn't feel very warm where they are, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I thought he captured that very well. Now, with Midian, I thought it was quite interesting that Midian is like a sanctuary. But I guess with like sanctuary, though, you know, basically like if you claim sanctuary in the church, like when we covered Hunchback of Notre Dame, basically what that means is that you stay inside that church. So you're kind of like a prisoner within that, within your own sanctuary. So you may be free, but you're free. You're a free prisoner. And I thought that that's pretty much what Midian was. I mean, here are these mythical creatures or beasts or people, and basically what they have is, yeah, people are leaving them alone and they're safe, but at the same time they are prisoners in their own safety, and then they have to be forced to fight to get their freedom. And how they don't want, you know, some of them don't want to fight for their freedom. They just, you know, you become quite submissive in the safety net that you harvest yourself in.
Well, what happened, I agree with what you say. They were like, they were free, but they were like, yeah, in that place, they were like, they were not leaving that place. But if you see, there were like a lot of people in the book, when Laurie was walking in the graveyard, she could see there were tombs from different places, from different languages. So it's like, I don't know. At that point, I thought, okay, it was like all kind of monsters. I don't know how to call them, coming from different parts from the world to that place to stay there. So if you see it like that, probably it's not like a prison. It's like a destination of where to go if you are like one of them.
Yeah, I guess it's a bit like
final destination.
Yeah, well, it'd be a simple fact that you're born in the town that you're born into. And you can't leave that town ever to live amongst the world, sort of thing, and experience the world.
And it's like me, essentially.
You never leave essentially ever.
I can never escape.
I mean, God forbid. I mean, I grew up in a very, very small farm town of 1,800 people. My graduating class had 30 people in it, and that covered 5 towns. So, and the nearest city is a 4-hour drive. So, I mean, if that was rules for me, I probably would have shot myself in the face with a shotgun by now, sort of thing, because it's just, you know, because you kind of have to like get out and, you know, and be able to move, but figure that, suppose you can't. And I guess, and You know, but then again, you do see that with people who, like in small towns sort of thing, is that from generation to generation to generation, the family stays there sort of thing. Because there is a safety net there. There is a safetiness to it. But at the same time, there is, you have to worry about things like your brain doesn't fully, maybe not fully envelop the outside world and doesn't change with the times and doesn't become more free thinking. And you kind of, and you find yourself getting quite settled down with laws and that's what you find with the creatures of Midian sort of thing that, you know, they're not, they have all these laws and stuff that they can and cannot do. And they seem to, which I felt in Kabbalah, it seemed like they were organic laws that kind of like, okay, well, this happened once, so therefore this can't happen again. This happened once, so this can't happen again, because you need to keep the safety of everyone here.
Do you think, in a way, the Midian represented, maybe in terms of Clive Barker's personal life, do you think that the Midian represented, you know, his desires and things he was doing, and then this being exposed to the police and the human nature side of things and the sunlight could represent him having to reveal himself and to come out of the closet, so to speak?
You probably could put it into that way, because at the end what happens is that once you come out of that closet sort of thing, then you need to start finding your new home and rebuilding your family sometimes. And that's what Midian has to do. I have to sit there and say that out of all the characters, I found Boone kind of irritating.
Why?
I think it's because, first of all, it's like what we have is this person who seems to have a lot of conflict, whether it's emotional conflict or personality conflicts. And I mean, I guess, was he bipolar? I guess, because they don't really say what his mental illness is. He's seeing a psychiatrist that we know. But then it's kind of like, but he seems quite weak-minded to be able to be fed that, you know, he's going to see a psychiatrist for whatever reasons. We're not quite sure. He's not able to commit to Lori. Lori doesn't really know. I mean, that's, you know, I like Lori character a lot, but you never quite understood what exactly did she see in Boone, because Boone did not seem like the ideal boyfriend at any time, even before, you know, he goes on the run or anything like this. You know, she never knew where she stood with him, sort of thing. And no one knew it. You know, he's always conflicted. He's a man with a curse or whatever is going on with him. And then he goes to a psychiatrist who's able to feed him to make him think that he's a serial killer. And, you know, and then he tries to top himself without facing the music or trying to figure out how this is going to go. And then he kind of runs to Midian. And then he puts everyone at risk at Midian for his own personal gain. I know he's to save Lori and whatever like that. And then Lori has to sit there and give him sex to bring him back to himself, so he goes back to Midian and, you know, help fix the fault that he caused. And I found, you know, for me, Boone for me was, he was annoying. A lot of times you're like, we don't really get into Boone's head either, though, because as I said before, we're like an outsider at the beginning with Boone up until, you know, the point where he tries to commit suicide, and then he runs off to Midian and then he dies. And this is all done like the prologue sort of thing, but we don't really get inside his head anyway. We're kind of like looking at it from a spectator's point of view. And then we go to Lori's story. Now we're inside Lori's head all the time, all the way through to the very end. So that it might be because of that, but I would sit there and say that if I was Lori and Boone was my boyfriend, I'd be like, well, he's dead, I'm going to move on.
Never really. Well, I think it's like Boone was having like problems, right? Like not accepting that he was, I don't know, listen to those voices and all that at the beginning. And then you have the perfect psychiatrist that is like mental, you know, that's killing people, and have the perfect person to blame, because that person can, I don't know, have, I think it's called lapsus, you know, when you lost a part of your mind and you don't remember what you have done or something like that. So he was the perfect plant. So if he was discovered, he could say, no, it's this man. And actually he did it, you know. And in a moment he was saying, well, look, I have everything recorded here that you have admitted that you have killed them, but he didn't do it. But then I started to think, well, maybe he did few of them because he was turning into, in a way, into what he was going to be. I don't know. I thought about that, but I thought, well, maybe it's just an idea. Just...
Well, I guess, I mean, he's, you know, he's fed into bleeding. Now, I found Decker a very interesting character. I quite like Decker. I mean, I mean, I don't know if I would go him to him as a patient. I mean, he does have a mask that speaks to him, you know. I mean, I have a mask.
He reminded me of the Scarecrow from Batman.
Yeah. Yes, that reminds me. Yeah, you're right.
With the zipper mouth and stuff like this. And though I have to sit there and say that his master plan is kind of flawed to a certain extent, I guess. Because I guess, you know, because his plan is, okay, Boone will take the rap for this. But then after Boone takes the rap for this, then his plan was to leave Vancouver and start somewhere else and do the killings all over again. And you're thinking, well, you better change your MO, because basically he's like, of all these, the killings that he did all have the same way of killing, didn't they? And basically it's like, you know, he had his old MO or murders operandi sort of thing. And basically, you know, he go through and he wipe out a family sort of thing. And then basically, you know, the way he cut and the way he sliced and the way that he killed them, he killed everyone in the same fashion. So, and I thought to myself, was like, well, you know, if you're going to move to a different country, and I say that, and this was his plan was, Boone takes the fall, I'll move on, change my name, and basically start a new practice, and I'll start killing all over again. You're thinking, well, Boone's not going to stay in prison very much longer if you're, you know, because I mean, he wasn't like just killing one or two people. I mean, he was a, you know, serial killer. He was killing quite a few people, wasn't he? Families and children and so on and so forth. So I thought, you know, for master plan, it's kind of a failed master plan, really. This is what you're doing, sort of thing. But I mean, this is before social media and mass communication and everything that we have nowadays, where I think, you know, I don't think Decker, to be honest, I don't think Decker could survive in 2021 now with DNA and CCTV and being watched all the time. And,
yeah.
You know, but I guess, you know, back at the time this is written, 1988 when this is written. And, you know, it was a different world back then, I suppose. Now, but yeah, so I quite like that, you know, I did like Decker, but I also like what Clive Barker was also saying, that basically that if you look a certain type, if you look clean, brushed up, suit, look professional, you can get away with pretty much anything. But obviously the people who are wearing suits, and if you look at the people wearing suits, the minister wears a suit, you know, minister garb, basically a uniform, I guess more of a uniform. You got Decker in his lawyer uniform. You got the police in their uniform. And it's almost like they're the one, and they end up being, the people in uniform are not the ones to be trusted, which is quite
amazing. You know, you remind me, there is a movie called Catch Me If You Can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what was the name of this man? The one from the last movie, the previous book.
Oh, Dead Zone.
David Cronenberg.
No, what was the name? Hold on. The death of Leonardo DiCaprio. Well, he said to Leonardo DiCaprio, walking. Look, yes. He said, always wear a like a suit and tie, because if you're like doing something like illegal, that he was doing at the airport, they will never stop someone with a suit and tie on that time of the day, that time, right? It will stop someone that looks more casual and suspicious rather than a professional, you know. So he was all the time dressing really, really smart and getting, I don't know, like drinks or things for free. So,
well, I mean, if you look at, like, if you want to shoplift, if you go in looking like a hobo, chances are you're not going to get away with it. But if you go in looking like a successful business person, they're going to be like, oh, they're not going to be shoplifting.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. And I thought that was quite interesting, because you do get that in Cabal a lot, basically, is that anyone who's wearing a uniform or looking respectable, they seem to get away with a lot. And then, and Boone seemed to be like a bit of a renegade, I guess, where, you know, I mean, I don't think he changes his clothes at all during the thingy. I think he dies he basically tries to kill himself in his set of clothes. And then he's pretty much wearing those clothes to the very end. He doesn't change his clothes. But he's pretty much quite stinky by the end of the novel.
Well, I think he was the only one who can transform and then be in the sunlight. The others they couldn't do it. Mm. So again, what you're saying about being who he really was, that beast, and then go back to look like a normal person that no one could know that he was that.
Well, when we covered Dead Zone last month, we talked about destiny. And so do you think that basically everything that happens to Boone is because of destiny? Because you do find out that the story of Boone was foretold, centuries and centuries before that. So everything that happens in this book was meant to happen. So because Boone is the savior, he becomes Cabal. And it's up for, and what we do find out is that Cabal is going to be the freer of the underdwellers of the Meridian. It's going to be the freer of that. But in order to free it, he has to open them up to the world in order to free it. And this is what Boone's main duty is. So do you think that, so basically since Boone's birth, do you think this is all predestined then?
Well, to me, yes and no. I mean, definitely he was not kind of like happy how he was before he turned into Cabal, right? Mm-hmm. And he wanted to find that place. He wanted to go to Medium. So it's like he probably, if he would have, ended in jail without being able to leave at all, probably his destiny would have been not being him. But I don't know. It's a bit, for me, it's a bit hard to talk about because it's a story written by someone, so you can't change the end of the story. You know, it has been. But I think I know what you mean, and I think that yes, and I think he was like, that was he was deep down what he was looking for, so to end there for good or bad.
By yourself, Craig, do you think that he could have changed his destiny? Do you think this is like he was on that course and that's pretty much it? There's no way to leave that course?
I mean, it could be destiny led by Decker, but I think maybe in some formal way, like death would have followed him. And it would have been in the form of the Cenobites, or it could have been someone from Midian or something. And the way he was going in his life, especially, I know mental health was not taken seriously back then, but if he was on a path of like suspected bipolar or outbursts and criminal history and things, then at some point he was going to have to face his demons in another way, probably. So probably destiny was set for him. There was an alternative ending in the movie as well, which at the end, part of the prophecy, Boone and Laurie now appeared as a painting, a breed painting. So that would obviously tie in with on them from the movie side. I like the whole idea that there is a destiny and things happen for a reason. And
I mean, I guess how I kind of look at this is that, a bit like in Dead Zone as well, because basically there seems to be a destiny that you can't change sort of things, but the characters are kind of stuck in this thing that's propelling them forward to the finale, that no matter what they try to do, it's, it's going to give them this finale sort of thing. And it seems like, if Midian does happen and you have this prophecy that's supposed to happen and it's going to happen at some point, and then you do have this person that does show up that who is an innocent, who gets bitten, who gets turned into the Nightbreed, which Boone was an innocent because he wasn't guilty of anything. He didn't kill anybody. He was an innocent. And this is part of the prophecy. So basically, what you have is all these horrible things were foretold, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And eventually if a prophecy does happen, okay, this is the prophecy sort of thing, and it's told hundreds and hundreds of years, that basically someone has to be born to that destiny in order for this to happen. Because when it does happen, it's just like, that means this person has no choice because, you know, a clean person, you know, an innocence that needs to be killed by a Nightbreed. Then they become the Nightbreed, and then when they become the Nightbreed, they have to bring doom onto the Meridian or the sanctuary that they're in, so that, and then they're going to break free, and a bunch of them are going to be murdered, but a bunch of them will become free, and then they'll be looking for a new home, and they will rebuild. And this is their prophecy, and their prophecy is built on this one man basically being the one bitten and turning the tide of the story. Yeah, I mean, I'm quite thankful. I mean, I think if it was me that had a destiny, I probably would have screwed it up by now, because I'm the kind of person that if you drop something, I'll pick it up and give it to you. But if you ask me to pick it up for you, I probably won't. So I'm one of those people sort of thing. But so I thought that was quite interesting that basically, and I always kind of find that when you have like prophecies and stuff like this, and then you have, and you know, if you're reading a story, but then you have a character that basically has to fulfill that prophecy. And then you're kind of thinking how much of this character has free will about everything that happened to him. And if you look at, you know, if you look at life anyway, life is a series of events anyway, that leads you to where you are now and scopes and changes everything that you are. But if you do have a destiny and this is what your end game is over here, that means that all of these little events have to add up to this here, because you are the chosen person to do this. So therefore, and I thought that, you know, when you look beyond that, I mean, the book doesn't go too much into that, but when you do, think outside of the book and start thinking of Boone's destiny, that he has to be this person. So that means he has to come into control with Decker. He has to try to, you know, he has to try to commit suicide. He has to meet this other character. So then, because he is the prophecy, he has to get the Midian to fulfill this prophecy sort of thing. And it kind of screws your mind a little bit, actually. It's like trying to figure out, you know, John Connor's father in Terminator. You know, you guys like, okay, you know, it's like when you look at that sort of thing, it's like, okay, basically it's like the world has to end. So no matter what you do, the world has to end, because this guy in the future has to come back and impregnate this woman to have this child, so to be able to send this guy back so he can be born. So it's like, so it does have that kind of about Meridian itself and the creatures. I think the only thing I could say about Cabal is I like the length of it. And I like the way that it moved, but I kind of wanted to meet a little bit more. I think some of the creatures are kind of left to the side. You kind of get a little bit of Buffett, the little deer girl. Well, I mean, I don't know. I said today, he doesn't give a lot of descriptions of what these characters look like in the book. And I sit there and say that a lot of the characters from the movie are kind of washing in, but I remember not feeling, but you know, it'd been nice to have a little bit more about Rachel and Buffett and Baphomet and Narcissus and all those characters, because you don't get a lot about them a lot. You don't get, and even the descriptions of them are, he doesn't give a lot of descriptions of them sort of things. You get a sense of who they are, but you don't really get to know a lot about them. And I think that he probably could have expanded on them a little bit more, because I kind of wanted to know a bit more about them.
Even Narcisse, you think, like, why was he there in the first place, and why did he need to rip the skin from his head in the first place, and
what yeah, that was
like, very random.
Why would he, another thing is I didn't understand is, like, how do you become part of Meridian? Because, you know, they said that, you know, so basically is it, you know, this is why I got a bit confused, and maybe you guys picked up.
He was almost like a gatekeeper, really, wasn't he?
Yes.
Well, if Boone's an innocent and it's against Meridian law for an innocence to be turned into Nightbreed, this is what we're told. So that means that everyone at Meridian has done something bad to become Nightbreed. So if you do something bad, that means you can be turned into Nightbreed. So is Meridian like a bunch of like thieves? And I mean, I don't, because another thing is, you don't know if they're born that way or they're turned that way. All we know is that you can't turn an innocence into Nightbreed. And then of course Boone gets bit and he runs off and of course he gets shot. And of course that turn, you know, and his death is, his rebirth to the Nightbreed sort of thing. But you're never quite sure, because you do find out with, when Narses rips his face off, he's like, I'm revealing myself to you, so therefore you can take me to Meridian sort of thing. And I mean, he was a bit, he has some psychological issues anyway. I mean, to be able to tear your face off and wanting to go to Midian. But then you kind of, but when Narses comes across as he doesn't come across as innocent. I don't know what he's done or anything like that, but he's not 100% there as far as, what we would consider a state of mental health for a normal person sort of thing. But there is this thing about, when you go to Midian, you can only, you search out Midian if you've done something, but you're not quite sure what you've done. Are you like a pedophile? Are you a murderer? Are you just a person who just like was born under a bad sign? Or, and I thought that, I guess in one way it's quite good that it's quite open, but another way it's kind of, I kind of wanted to know more. So this novel did leave me wanting more about what exactly are the mechanics of Midian and how does this world run and how do you become a Nightbreed? Are they born into it? Or are they turned into it? Is it like vampires or werewolves or, where you have to be bitten or scratched, or is it part of your family legacy or, And I understand that there are myths and legends around places, and there are myths and legends around places today, sort of thing. And I know that people, whether if you're looking at religion with heaven, and whether you're religious or not, there is a mythology around heaven that the way to get to heaven is to be doing this, and this gets you this place after death, sort of thing. And there are rules and regulations with vampirisms and werewolves and demons and fairies and so on and so forth. And I thought that Clive Barker kind of skitted around the issue a little bit about the Nightbreed and Midian. I wanted more about that. But outside of that, I think it's quite a worthwhile book, and I would highly recommend it. What about yourself, Leandro? Would you recommend Cabal?
Yeah, because I don't know. It's like... from other terror stories that I have read, is totally different. I like the way that it's like a crime story along, right? I would recommend it. And I like it because also, as Craig said, it's not a really long book, so it's easy to read. And yeah, I would.
What about yourself, Craig? Would you recommend Nightbreed? Cabal.
Cabal, I would say if it's an introduction to horror novels with like a psychological thriller aspect, then I'd definitely recommend it. And if you're into like primal cult horror tribes and people and prophecies and things like that, then it's right up your street. And you'll get a shock if you order Ghost Story. It's a big one. If you compare the two.
We're going to try something out, something slightly different here. Of a rating of 5 killer Decker blades, how many killer Decker blades would you give Cabal? Starting with you, Craig.
Oh, yeah, I'll give it 5 Decker blades out of 5 for Cabal, yeah.
And what about yourself, Leandro?
Yeah, 5, yeah.
I think I'll give it 5 as well, actually. I actually really enjoyed this. This is actually the third time I've actually read this. Everything. I read it when it first came out. And I read it... I read it afterwards. But that's a story for another time. But this is the third time.
And what was your, like... Because I used to have a teacher once at university that said that you really understand... the writer's view, not the first time you read the book. because the first time you don't know what was going to happen in the story, so you're more concentrated was to know what was going to happen to the character. Then the second time you read it, you know the story, so then you start to see things before you couldn't realize because you were just following the story how it, to see what was going to happen. And they said the more that you read it, the more that you realize how the writer is writing the things to let you, you know what I mean, let you know what he wants you to know. So what was your, like, kind of personal reading like this for the third time or for...
The first time I read this, it was after I was I read all the Books of Blood, which are fantastic. I highly recommend Clive Barker's The Books of Blood, volumes 1 through 4. Excellent. Best short story going. I mean, it takes Stephen King and makes Stephen King look like a pussy, Books of Blood, and so I highly recommend those. Then I read Cabal, so I read it the first time. And then after that, I started dating Clive Barker for a little while. So I read it the second time when I was with him, sort of thing, because you know, I was looking at things like that. And then this is the third time. So the first time I loved it because I thought that I loved Books of Blood and because this was a novelette sort of thing. And it kind of, Hellraiser just came out sort of thing. And I kind of was in the Clive Barker before Hellraiser. So I never read Hellbound Heart or any of those things or anything to deal with Hellraiser. So that was just a movie for me. But for me, this felt to the same kind of lines as Books of Blood. Then I kind of went into deeper things like Damnation Game and Weed World and The Draven Secret Show and so on and so forth after that. And Cold Heart Canyon, I think it's the last one I read for him. And I kind of dropped off from him for a little while now. And I thought Cabal was fantastic. Reading it this time around, I felt it moved very, very well for me, and I felt it moved well. And did I learn anything new? No. To me, it's just like a elongated short story. Is what it felt like to me. And it's like everything's there, but I have to sit there and say that what I found fulfilling the first time around. This time, I kind of wanted to know more, and I wanted to know more. Like I said before, about medium and things like this. So, and emotionally. I find the novel all inspiring, and I find it very, you know, it fills me with awe, you know, about the Midian and everything that's going on around it. But emotionally, it doesn't affect me emotionally. You know, one of my books that I read that I read like 6 or 7 times is A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving. And every time I read that, I cry by the end of it. And it's the only novel I know that makes me actually feel emotionally vulnerable. And so Cabal doesn't do that to me, but I do think that it's one that it's interesting to look at it from different decades of, you know, your life sort of thing. And, you know, not if I had a chance to read it again or something like that, I probably would. I would have a problem with it. Nightbreed, which is a 1990 American dark fantasy horror film written and directed by Clive Barker, based on his 1988 novella, Cabal. It stars Craig Schaefer and Bobby, David Cronenberg, Charles Haig, Hugh Crosshie, and Doug Bradley. Doug Bradley is Pinhead from Hellraiser, just so you know who he is. The film follows an unstable mental patient named Aaron Boone, who is falsely led to believe by his doctor that he is a serial killer. Tracked down by the police, his doctor and his girlfriend, Lori, Boone eventually finds refuge in an abandoned cemetery called Midian among a tribe of monsters and outcasts known as the Nightbreed who hide from humanity. At the time of its release, the film was a commercial and critical failure. In several interviews, Barker protested that the film company tries to sell it as a standard slasher film and that the powers that be had no real working knowledge of Nightbreed's story. Since its initial theatrical release, Nightbreed had become a cult film. Over time, Barker expressed disappointment with the final cut, approved by the studio and always longed for the recovery of the reels so the film might be re-edited. In 2014, the original film elements for the cut material were reobtained and re-edited into a director's cut released through Screen Factory, which is available today. So So we're going to do is cut to the trailer of Nightbreed. We're right back.
Something is breeding there.
From Clive Barker, creator of the award-winning box office hit Hellraiser, comes the spectacular adult fantasy adventure, Nightbreed. From the beginning, there have been monsters, a race of exotic creatures and extraordinary beings hidden from the sight of mankind for centuries. These are the Nightbreed. Their refuge is a place called Midian, where only monsters are welcome. But then, isn't there something monstrous in all of us?
Are you prepared to be judged by the gods?
Starring Craig Sheffer from Some Kind of Wonderful, Anne Bobby from Born on the 4th of July, and David Cronenberg, director of The Fly, in his first major acting role. Featuring superb special effects from the people who brought you the creatures in Hellraiser and Lair of the White Worm, Nightbreed delivers throat-gripping excitement. An adult fantasy that doesn't kid around.
Believe me? I believe you.
He's got a gun!
Come, meet the dead of night.
Hello, welcome back to the Literary License Podcast, and we're discussing Nightbreed from 1990. And Leandro, what are your thoughts of Nightbreed?
Well, I really enjoyed the movie. The visual effects, you know, were really interesting. There was one part that Bonnie turned around and looked the place, the whole place set it on fire, and you realize that it's like a picture. In the old days they used to not have 3D, so they have to put one picture and then on behind another one, then you have to record it like that. So that was really interesting that they merged that with other effects that were like, you know, fire and explosion that were really, really cool. I really, as Craig said, yeah, this the doctor, when he was putting that mask, remind me Batman.
Yeah,
I really enjoy some visual effects were really like clever, I think. And the one they were showing different, you know, characters. I enjoyed, you know, like for example, you know, when there was one that the little girl, for example, she was under the sun and she was changing all the shape, and then when they bring it inside, it came back to how she was. So I think that was really clever how they made it. Yeah, I really enjoyed the movie. I would recommend it. And I know that probably the writer was complaining about that there was a failure, but now you have to pay to watch that movie over YouTube or wherever any platform you were trying to find it. You have to pay. So they're making money now. Not back then.
All right, so Craig, what are your thoughts on Nightbreed?
Well, they're probably going to release a director's cut soon, hopefully, and then they'll probably charge £2 more on Amazon Prime.
I actually have a director's cut, so if you guys are interested, I can email that to you if you want.
Yeah, I definitely want to see that. Yeah, I enjoyed the movie, and I love the idea of like monsters in folklore, monsters who are brought to the edge and they're living together and surviving. And I love the idea of Midian itself, because in my spare time when I'm photographing, I'll often go to the southwest of Cornwall and go to the ancient monument and burial sites. And I've catalogued most of Cornwall's ancient stones and things. And there's one that in particular called Man Atoll. And the legend is that back in the early centuries, it's basically a circular hole. It looks like a polo. And they would pass, people would walk through the hole to become healed. And I was so intrigued, and I got right through the hole myself. I've never felt the same since. But you know, it's just a great idea, really good a concept and idea. Because even some of the standing stone circles that I visited, there's one called the Nine Maidens, and it's supposed to be like these, you know, maidens that were fossilized and turned into stones, you know, down to folklore and things like that. And, you know, you just don't know if these places, you know, it gets you thinking, and you think like, God, did this really happen? You know, and, you know, could there be places like Midian that you just walk into and you go beyond the void of reality? You know, you just don't know. It's kind of cool. I still think, though, what I said earlier, I think as an animation, or the concept of Midian itself would have been better as an animation. For the budget that they had at the time and for what they did, I think that they pulled it off quite well. I mean, because you had the slasher, as the psychological side of stuff with the slasher with Decker, you had the monsters against monsters almost, you know, and then you've got the Beauty and the Beast aspect of the romance. I would have liked, I mean, it was a bit, reminded me of Labyrinth. There was this scene that I remember quite clearly where there was a wolf-like creature that, and there was another night breed, and she was called Rachel, I think, and she was made of smoke, and she just appeared really well. I mean, it was just amazing. And then the wolf creature became a little girl, I think, as she transcended into the safe zone of the city. And it was things like that that made me think, wow, they actually really did pull off another dimensional world really well. Like, even in Labyrinth, with David Bowie, you know, when the girls, you know, searching through I can't remember the name of it, but it's like a maze, and she's walking along, and then there's just like a brick wall, but the brick wall isn't just a brick wall, it's a hologram into another section of the labyrinth, and then there's talking worms talking to her out of bricks and things, and then you realize, you're like, you know, are we now in a psychosis of the main character at the moment? And then you start to question, like, you know, what's reality? You know, some beautiful creature designs. I mean, Peliquin, I love that character so much, even the voice, and he was awesome, man. I would love to see like an origin story of Peliquin or a sequel or something, and see what they're getting up to, sort of thing. And the porcupine girl, she was cool. I would have loved, though, that scene when she came out and she was shooting the policeman with the little darts. I would have really liked her to have been like a peacock sort of thing, and then just poison darted them. It reminded me of Critters, actually, when the critters start poison darting people in the necks, because it's kind of freaky, because you're thinking that is venom, and that, you know, there's no way you're going to get out of that one, really, because you're going to go unconscious. And that kind of put me on edge a little bit there. It was a bit, kind of made me feel a bit uneasy, which is a good reaction. I watched it several times, because it was my first time watching it. But I noticed in the opening scenes as well, it was the opening scene. As soon as I heard the opening scene, I knew it was Danny Elfman. I mean, what a beautiful soundtrack. I mean, and then he did the shots of the creatures that you were going to see as the title came across the screen. That was really, really well done, because it drew you in. You thought, wow, this is going to be like a roller coaster of a movie, you know, when that scene came up. So, yeah, that's a few of my favorite bits.
For me, Nightbreed, I went to see it when it first came out. Enjoyed it. I enjoyed it this time around. I have to sit there and say, though, it did have like a TV feel about it, the way that it's filmed, because everything felt like, and I guess my only complaint about this is that it felt like everything was done on a studio backlot. You know what I mean? There's been like what you were saying, like, you know, like the Wizard of Oz when she's skipping on the Oliver Grove, like, stop, you're going to bump into the back, you're going to bump into the backdrop sort of thing. And then I kind of have that backdrop feel to it. And I think that if Clive Barker maybe had, because the only film he made before this was Hellraiser. And I think Hellraiser works because it's quite dark and gritty. It's quite a dark and gritty film. And this one's kind of bright and like you know, kind of everything's kind of like in the daytime anyway. And I found that watching it this time around and looking at it more with a critical eye sort of thing, I thought that if he did it a bit darker, you know, so therefore it's like the makeup of the creatures didn't look so much like makeup sort of thing. And, you know, you can hide things in shadows and stuff like this. And you can hide, because Midian did look like it was like in someone's soundstage. A lot of it did sort of thing. And it's like, you know, it's like watching Buffy, you know, you're watching Buffy and she's kicking ass in a cemetery and you know that's done in the parking lot of the Buffy studios. Do you know what I mean? Because you know that because you just knew that those tombstones were not permanent features, you know, and I think that when he did location shots and stuff like that, that was fantastic. But then when he went back into the soundstage, it had that soundstage feel to it. And unfortunately, the brightness of the way it was filmed made it kind of look like a TV film, TV production. You know, there's the way the TV films things, and then there's what
yeah.
film.
Yep.
I mean, but over, and I felt that, and I love all the way up until the battle at Midian. But once we get to the battle at Midian, then the film kind of gets messy. You don't know what the hell's going on, sort of thing, because you got kind of like, you know, you need the fight, and you have these creatures that are behind like a, you know, when they come out sort of thing. And you know, I guess that, and then we kind of get Clyde Barker's, you know, puzzle box blue screen, you know, when the puzzle box closes and you have those electrical blue shock, you know, electric things going through. We kind of get that. And this is why I was like, oh, there's Hellraiser. It's Clyde Barker's Hellraiser, electric sort of thing. But I think, you know, for the amount of, it'd be interesting to know that if they did remake this, and you know, if the TV production comes out of it and stuff like this, or I wonder what this would have been like if it was someone who wasn't so close to it. You know, Clyde Barker wrote it, and then he wrote the book, and then he wrote and directed this. And I'm wondering that if you look at like Candyman, which is also based on a Clyde Barker story called The Forbidden. And you look at the way that's done, by the way George Rose was able to put that into and make that into a film. And that has like a really grittiness to it. Because I think the only thing that this film lacks, I think it would have been better if it was gritty. Because even like that when Decker comes in and kills the family, it kind of like, you know, outside of her being overweight and the family just kind of looked like a TV family. Do you know what I mean? It's like you just walked into the set of Wonder Years. This is a Wonder Years family, and it's like he's going to be killing them. It's like
it reminded me of Halloween 6, where the old lady's on the telephone, I think, and then Mike Myles just turns up and then wipes out the family, and it just reminded me of that.
And this one looked like a TV family, you know, like a, you know, the next door neighbors to Roseanne. Yeah, but when I look at the script and stuff like this, I mean it's an enjoyable film. I did enjoy it, but I have to say, looking at it this time around, I thought to myself, like, God, this looks very TV. It feels like a TV movie. It feels like not even like a made for Netflix. It feels like a made for the kind of Channel 5 shows here in the UK. You know, it's like, oh, I need to go to bed, but I'll just put out, you know, and then you find yourself watching this really cheesy Channel 5 movie, and you can't, and then you find yourself at 2:30 watching like somebody from Charlie's Angels or some old TV show, like being chased around by a serial killer, and you're like, why am I watching this? But you can't stop. It kind of had that kind of feel to it.
There were a few things that called my attention. One is like when Bond was on in prison, right? And then the sheriff, I think, went to hit him, right? Mm-hmm. After hit him, the police officer, you know, lighted a cigarette for him. And I don't know, Tommy, well, you know, you were talking about this story is a bit like really like sexual. It's like, okay, you have pleasure punching someone, now you have a cigarette, right? And then that really caught my attention. I don't know. Then when they were in the prison, then when they were about to go to put all TNT and all the place and kill all of them, there was a sign where all the guns say we fight for freedom or something like that in yellow, and I thought it was really strange that is in a jail.
I think
you're far from freedom, but you are in a jail, you know. So for me, was that was really like clever to put that sign there.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean,
maybe that's a play on.
This might be a British version, a British person's version of North America, but I thought it was really weird that when they went to the to get the guns and everything, the fleet, you know, the townspeople, and they had like AK-47s and all this stuff. Like, you don't have that. It's like not
flamethrowers,
guns and pistols, but you don't have like AK-47s and bomb throwers. Like,
and it was really funny because they were like the police station of a really small town in the middle of nowhere, and they have an arsenal of things to go to kill the world.
Yeah. And I know that we have like, you know, I know that in America we do have gun freedom and stuff like that, but you know, all that, all those guns, they're not available to buy at Walmart. You know, they're just not, you know, you might get some, you get rifles and maybe some pistols and maybe some shotguns, but yeah, you're not going to come up with like wars of mass destruction out of the local places.
Going back to what Leandro said about the film cells on top of each other for the sequences, it was Star Wars art concept artist Ralph McQuarrie who painted the Necropolis sequences and that at Pinewood Studios, and it was Clive's dream to be the Star Wars of TV monsters, I think, at the time.
Oh wow!
And he only had a couple of chapters to work off of from the book, so they did pretty well, I think.
I think it, to me, I think it's the film stock. I think he should have used a darker film stock, sort of thing. Nothing so bright. But I think it's also because I think he wanted to. But I think this has to do with Hellraiser. He raised the money for that and stuff like this on his own.
And what do you think?
And he made that Mental Hill.
What do you think about when Pelequin was going to bite Boone? He was already a grotesque monster, like a demon with the dreads and that. But then they tried to make him even more horrific, sort of thing. And he was shaking, and then the teeth came out. And I was thinking it was really unusual. I've never seen a monster become another monster, something to become more scary than what they already are. It was quite interesting.
Well, see, another thing that we don't know either is like, because we get like Buffett. Basically, she can turn to like a little girl, and then we had, the gay guy with the dog, and he looked normal. Yeah. I don't know what his Meridian story was, sort of thing. But it makes you ask a lot more questions. And then you have like all these other weird looking people, sort of thing. So do they just stay looking weird? Can they transform? Because they're all about everyone else. You know, your main characters can transform, but everyone in the background can't. Like, what's going on?
There was this weird Tim Burton moment where one guy had a protruding stomach, and then suddenly sandworms came out and round his neck, and that was a bit of a Tim Burton thing going on there. Like, even the music, I thought, am I watching Beetlejuice for a second? It was a bit strange.
Well, another thing I found kind of weird about that guy, I mean, I do like this film, it's going to tear apart, but he's like, you know, he's got these things that come out of his stomach, and they kind of curl around his neck, sort of thing. And he's like, and then someone's got a gun pointing at him, and he's like, you know, and I thought to myself, like, by the time they come out of his neck, and by the time they go into that guy's eye, this guy could have shot him like 8 or 9 times.
Yes.
I got my own, you know, weapon of mass destruction, and these things slowly cross his stomach. You know, it's been like watching a James Bond villain. It's like, I'm going to kill 100 million people, and this is why. And so, 15 minutes of this is like, never mind, just shoot him in the head. It's like, why do you have to listen to this? Sort of thing. But yeah, it was kind of, I mean, there's, and I do like that they did expand on the Nightbreed in this, that we do get a bit more expansion than we do in the novel of some of the creatures here. It does feel a bit rushed, though. It's like you've seen the beginning, and it's like rush, 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 rush. Now we're in Midian. So now the rest, you know, now we're in Midian. But I didn't like the only thing I probably compare to the novel that I wish they kept in is, I kind of wish that basically what would have happened is that Lori and her new friend go to Midian. She hangs around by the car. She walks through Midian. She saves Buffett. She goes back. She's devastated about the loss of Boone. Decides she's never going to back. And her friend's like going out. You know, her friend goes out on a date. And she goes, come on, the next day, come on, we go on a date. And then they go to the poor side of town and they go in a restaurant and that whole scene there. And I kind of wish, because I kind of like I liked her friend a lot. And I thought, so she's kind of dispensed it quickly out of that. And it would have been nice to have Lori, because basically Lori gives in the novel, which I think makes the novel work a little bit better than film, is that Lori gives up on Boone. And it's like, okay, I'm going back to my life now. And then because Decker kills her friend and then Decker tries to kill her, that forces her back to going back for Boone sort of thing. That realized that. And I think that I think in the movie we kind of needed that. This is kind of like, so Lori never gets up on Boone at all. Her main focus in the movie is just boom, 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 boom sort of thing. Mm. Now, did you see the director's cut or did you see the regular cut of this?
The regular. Okay.
The director's cut, which I will forward to you. The director's cut basically has a scene where the Nightbreed are in a barn. Boone is basically with Lori. We do get the book ending where she tries to kill herself. Boone bites her, brings her back to life, and then they got the Hollywood sun settling behind them, and they're gonna go find new homes for the Meridian. But we also get this odd little story sort of thing with the sheriff. Now, the sheriff, I think, in the movie is worse than the sheriff that's in the book. This one's kind of like a rural asshole sort of thing, a very racist kind of person. And I guess, you know, that works quite well for the film. And then we get the priest sort of got character who, instead of wearing women's underwear, he's now gay. You know, he's a gay priest. Big, which is not really a big deal because they're pretty much everywhere nowadays. It's like when do you see a priest that's not gay? But anyway, it's kind of an openly gay priest. And basically what happens is that, you know, the book basically has the gay, the women wearing priest basically with no arms and legs in a hospital bed. And the sheriff is pretty much seeing him because he thinks that they can find the Nightbreed, and kind of the book is kind of open ended, so he could write a sequel to it. This one, he's turned into a kind of a creature with a big head, and he kills the sheriff, and then basically he's going after the Nightbreed. This priest character is with, you know, kind of with a kind of like Liberace going after, you know, kind of like, trying to be evil sort of thing. So it's kind of a weird thingy. But another thing that you also get is that at the end of the title cards, what you do is you get Decker, who isn't dead, which is kind of weird as well, because Decker at the end of the day is mortal, and he wasn't bitten by anyone or anything like that. So you kind of get that. So that's what you have with the director's cut. Though it does stick to the book mostly, there are some changes in the book that I think that the movie would have benefited a little bit for character development. For the part of Lori, and I think it's with her friend. It would have been nice if that took over for like 2 or 3 days sort of thing that happens in the book, because that way when her friend dies, you feel more of a loss. Now she just kind of feels like, you know, victim number 4 in a Friday the 13th film, you know, without her tits out. But what do you think works in the film?
The doctor and patient aspect is really intriguing from a psychological point of view, where almost it's being led by the psycho psychologist. You know, it's quite interesting. You know, Destiny's being led by this individual, and I'm thinking, in terms of the prophecy, how does Decker fit into that? And is he, you know, is he more than mortal, you know, existentially? But I would have liked to have seen more of Baphomet. I would have liked to have seen him interact. And it was a very cool design, really cool. It was like an artwork that you'd find in a gallery. But I would have liked, you know, like in Ghoulies 2, where they've done the spell, there's a big ghoulie at the end, it's stomping around. That would have been good. And then all Baphomet needed to do was breathe fire on all the bastards and wipe everyone out and save Meridian. And obviously the prophecy didn't go that way.
I have to say that character design for him kind of looked like Alien.
Yeah.
Or Species. I can't
remember that famous artist who does Is it Geiger?
Yeah. So it kind of had that kind of a feel to it, I thought to myself. Yeah. And I kind of wish that it was a bit more mobile, because it felt like a statue. And then when you finally do get to see the character speak, it does look like someone's put their face inside the statue. Because he doesn't say anything. He's kind of like he just stands there and doesn't move at all. Mm-hmm. And it kind of like you get these, you know, the lights shining and stuff like this. And apparently he speaks to Boone and casts him out of Meridian, but you don't hear him cast anything else. So you don't actually see the character move at all. And then when you do see him move, it's kind of like, oh, okay. And it just felt like, oh, he's opened his eyes and now he's speaking, sort of thing. So it'd be quite good if the character moved around a little bit and created a little bit more. I love the design. Like as you said, the design was fantastic and it opened a lot.
The makeup was excellent.
But it'd be nice if he could move around, because it's like, what, is he just stationary? Is his whole life basically just standing in one position for centuries and centuries? And what kind of life is that? It's kind of like I'm going to have a really long life. Well, okay, I'm going to have a really long life, but I'm going to be bedridden for it. It's like, well, that's not... it's like, I want a quality of life, not quantity, sort of thing. But I mean, I think overall, I think it's a very, very good film. I'm not going to take anything away from it. I think it's very, very faithful to the novel. Where it does diverge, I think that's where the movie kind of does suffer a little bit. I think that when it does diverge a little bit away from the novel, then when it tries to bring itself back to the novel, then it tends to get a bit messy. And then the action sequences, yeah, it was. I think if it had a director who was a bit more, who had a little bit more stuff behind him and to be able to focus on how to do action sequences, I think it probably would have been a bit easier. It got a bit messy. I got to a point where I was like, who's fighting who? It's been like, you know, when, like the Lord of the Rings films, like I love the first one, the second one. And then because there was a wait between the second and the third one, that when the third one came out, I'm watching like going, what in the hell's going on here? It's like all this is people fighting. I couldn't figure out who's fighting who. And it kind of felt a bit like that, because you got a lot of the, and I think it's because you got a lot of the creatures who are being killed off left, right, and center. And because you never saw these creatures before, it's kind of hard to, I think that in the film, probably what you would need is a Midian town meeting. And then they had like all the creatures there, and you know, and then they scan across the crowd, so that way you know who all of them are, sort of thing. So that way, then when
how would you?
Well, it's just
would you flame throw it or shoot?
Connect them when they're getting shot. You'd be like, so it's like when they're being shot, because most of them got shot in the back, didn't they? So it's like person with weird shots, another person with a weird headshot, sort of thing. So, but if they had like, if you could like differentiate them, so when they got shot, you know, it just felt like, it's like watching a war movie with like a cast of a thousand sort of thing. And they're like, you know, it's like you kind of got your American GIs and they're killing all, you know, they're in Vietnam killing all the Viet Cons or whatever like that. And the thing is, you can't differentiate any of the Viet Cons, because it's like you never see any of them individually. It's like there's just a group of people sort of thing. So yeah, I do think the action sequences probably could have been a bit more film better to give it a little bit more strength and power and feel more of a loss for the Midian.
What I like a lot is like, as Craig said, is like, you know, like the doctor when he was killing someone, right? You don't see any monster. It's just a man with a bag in the haze, but that builds on you, like, further the expectation to know who is behind that mask, who is this person, and all the psychological thing behind. I remember there is a movie called Saw. I don't know if you have seen them. And it's terror in a point, but it's not terror. It's like, it's just suspense, but it, like, and I really like it because, you know, when you grow up, maybe when you were a kid, you know, you see all monsters and you were getting scared. Then you get older and you know that that's not real, right? So you see it in a different way. And then this thing of suspense of knowing who is probably, who could be the bad person, but what you don't know how he's going to do, but you know he's going to do, is really cool. And when I watch movies that are really old, what I try to enjoy is, you know, how they made the visual effects at that time. Because, for example, this day with the computer, it's really easy to, I don't know, make fire, make a big explosion. But at that time, you know, it wasn't as easy as these days. So I really appreciate, you know, the way they did it. I mean, I know what they were not explaining. There were a lot of, like, different creatures that were appearing more and more and more. And you don't know where they're coming from. But at the same time, you know, they were, you know, in the part of the movie, they were saying that they wanted to go somewhere. And they were saying, no, that's the, kind of the forbidden part. You cannot go there because it's, like, kind of more, like, deep on the soil, on the ground. So I imagine that that's what they were trying to more or less, like, to explain in one way. But it, I know is that when you see them, everything is getting destroyed, you can kind of like feel anything because you haven't seen them before, just people running.
I think what you kind of needed maybe is, like, when Laurie's going through Midian, you know, when she wakes up,
yeah,
you kind of need that tour. And they do that, like, in,
yeah,
you know, where Kate Winslet's being talked around, she's taken around the ship, and they're like, this is where this happened, and this is where this happened. And you kind of go on a tour,
yeah,
and kind of see the thing. And I think that's probably what you could have put a little bit, I mean, you could probably added 2 or 3 minutes to the film, which probably wouldn't have been a deal, where Rachel's taking Laurie around Midian, and you get to see the different creatures and who this, and then, and behind this wall, these are the unspeakables sort of thing. We have to keep them whatever. Because when they do go, oh, we need to release them, it's like, where the hell they come from? And then you think to yourself, like, where the hell are you going to, now that they're out.
As well.
Yeah, now that they're out, you know, and they kill, I mean, I don't think any of them get killed, do they? I think they pretty much kill all the rednecks. It's not all rednecks.
It's funny.
The rednecks and the cops. But then it's like, where do they go afterwards? It's just like, you can't put them back up. They're just wandering the earth.
Well, I got it, like, those were like the monster for the monsters. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those were the beasts for them. You know, they couldn't control them unless they will release them. And even when Bond released them, he jumped out so that they don't kill him.
Yeah, but now they're released, and so now they're just roaming the earth.
It's a bit like the Muppets, and then in the Muppets, and then they release the Fraggles in Fraggle Rock, which was like a subterranean world that no one's supposed to know about, with these kooky people, you know. And I think now when I think about it, there is a Doctor Who episode called Asylum of the Daleks where the Daleks have got a subterranean cavern of Daleks that were too bad to be released to be around other Daleks because they're too crazy, you know.
Well, Superman had that quite... as well, didn't they? Isn't that like in the beginning of the original Superman film, you got the people that were trapped in the glass.
Oh, yeah.
They were too bad.
Yeah.
They brought them back for the sequel, of course. But I did wonder, it's like, what happened? Because the thing is, like, I think the last thing we do is that they blow up that truck sort of thing, you know, which, you know, had that redneck girl in it, that, you know, that white trash girl and the redneck guy, you know, so that, you know, the cops going there and it blows the truck up with those two in it. And then the rednecks go running off into the sunset sort of thing. And then they think, what happened to these berserkers? Where do they go? they're nowhere to be found. Are they just in Canada as we speak?
They're at the Greenwich Meridian.
Yeah, precisely. They're probably like, yeah, I mean, they're not going to do too much. You know, if you're looking for like human rights, you know, issues and for the Nightbreed can live amongst man. I mean, these people, these berserkers are not going to help your cause much, are they? It'd be like,
yeah. But. I love the style of special effects, though. I mean, I will obviously admit to everyone, I am a lover of really bad rubber 80s monsters movies, and nothing can get away from like a lot of special effects, the hours they must have gone through to make those beautiful designs. And I mean, Marvel aside, I mean, I do like a modern movie with good CGI, but you can't take it away from, you know, with especially the wolf creature. She looked beautiful. Man, I mean, it's just stunning artworks, you know, that you just don't get that anymore, because people are just on the computer and they're just clicking and stuff, and you know, people sculpted things. You've got sculptors, you've got claymation, all these people involved, and I take my hat off to them, man. They did a really
great pocket job,
man. The only one I didn't like, the only makeup effect I didn't like was Narcissus. Was it Narcissus?
With the
face off,
there's a guy who tore his face off. Yeah, I just want to give him a towel. Dry his
face. I think it's because when he changed over, it kind of looked like he was wearing a skull cap sort of thing. You know what I mean?
Shower cap. Yeah.
And it didn't look. I think all the other makeup effects were really, really good. It's just a him. And I think it has a lot to do with he's out in the daylight a lot, sort of thing. And so I think that, and I know that he tore his face off and stuff like this. But another thing is that when he tore his face off, he was tearing it off like this down the front as well, and that wasn't shown in the makeup design and stuff like this. And I thought he was out of book. He's the only person I can actually pick apart the makeup design. Though I have to say, sometimes Boone's face kind of made him look a bit. Down syndrome a little bit when he was changing. I don't mean to be horrible to people about that, but his face kind of went lopsided sometimes. then other times he would have like the designs on his face, and then so there's times like when sometimes that wasn't very consistent with him, but everyone else
I love the smoke that came out of people's mouths if they were touched by the Nightbreed or if they'd been possessed.
Yeah, that was really clever. Yeah, it's like the soul.
Right. And I like Rachel as well.
Yeah.
For some reason, when she goes in smoke, and then she becomes a human person, of course she's not wearing any clothes, she has glistening breasts, which I thought was quite interesting. It's all moist.
It's a shame the female protagonists in the 80s, they were always like forgotten about, but they were really, really good, man. I mean, look at Laurie Strode in Halloween, man. She's like, she's awesome. You know, I feel sorry for women in the 80s, in especially horror movies, because they just weren't taken very seriously.
I think there's a rebalance of that now, isn't there?
Unconscious bias and all that, but.
Because, I mean, if you look at the slasher films of the 70s and 80s, it's like the women running around. But if you look at the slasher films today, whether it's Ready or Not or Happy Death Day or something like this, now the women, you know, are scream. Now the women, like, kick ass. It's like, you know, they're not running away from anyone. They're like, bring it on. I'm coming for you, sort of thing. It's quite interesting. Kill Bill.
Watch Kill Bill. You'll see.
Yeah. So... Which I have to say, at some point we will cover those the modernization of slasher films sort of thing. So there's some stuff I really want to cover at some point. So. So, for Nightbreed, on a scale of 5, and how many beasts would you give this on a scale of 5, starting with you, Craig?
Well, Rotten Tomatoes gave this a 5.4 out of 10, but I'm going to give this a 4 out of 5. Eloquence.
Yeah, 4.5. or a five. Yeah, it was. I really enjoyed it. So
I'm going to give it 3.5. I do like the film, but I have to sit there and say that there are parts of the narrative that I wish could have been sharpened up a little bit more. I think if it had a great director, I think it'd be a great film. I love the creature effects. I love the beginning of it, but it gets really messy in the middle towards the end sort of thing. And I just think that if it had a darker design to it, I have to think if it was a darker looking film, I think it would have held it to me. It's kind of too bright. It felt like Smallville, Nightbreed done by Smallville or something like that. It's just a bit too bright for me. So, but I don't buy that. But yeah, I would actually look. There's a lot of films I wouldn't look forward to a remake, but I would actually look for a remake of this or a reboot or not because of practical effects, but just to see what they could do with the story or the TV series that they have. That they have in fact. It'd be interesting to see what a TV version of this would look like, or especially like if it's done by Netflix or something like that. Something like in the vein of The Witcher or something like that. This brings us to the end of the Literary License podcast. Of course, next week we'll be covering Bewitched, and we'll be covering 8 episodes in season 2, which were firmly in the Tabitha baby years. And our 2-for-1, the 80s, will be covering Killer Party from 1986, and Night of the Demons from 1988. And of course, we'll be continuing with Dark Shadows. We'll be covering the episodes from January 1969 through to March 1969, which will be a total of 45 episodes. And our next Books of Screams will be Peter Straub's Ghost Story, which is a long, fantastic novel I'm enjoying at the moment. I'm now past the 42% mark. And the film from 1981, Ghost Story. So I want to say goodnight to Craig. Goodnight, Craig.
Goodnight from essentially everybody.
Good night, Leandro.
Good night.
And we'll see you next month for Ghost Story by Peter Straub. Or next
in the hereafter, I've never seen someone like you. You're a knife, sharp and deadly. And it's me that you cut into. But I don't mind. In fact, I like it. Though I'm terrified, I'm turned on, but scared of you. Oh, she's a monster.
I don't mind. And I need her. heart, and she's playing with my mind. And I don't mind, I don't mind. No, I don't mind.